Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. One woman's chance encounter with family history led to a 20-year research project. Children's author Andrea Page is coming to the Siouxland Library's downtown branch in Sioux Falls tomorrow. Her book is called Sioux Code Talkers of World War II. I caught up with her last week for a conversation about language, cultural pride, and the men who saved the world.
My mother grew up in Kennel, South Dakota. And so we have family members out there, so we traveled often back and forth to the reservation on Standing Rock. I didn't personally live on the reservation. I grew up in Rochester, New York.
All right, and so let's talk about the book a little bit and how you first came across the story of John Bear King and others and how it piqued your interest in the beginning.
Oh, my gosh. We were actually sitting around at the kitchen table here at my parents' house, and she opened up a letter from her cousin, who was John Bear King's daughter, and she sent a newspaper article, and it had a photo in there, and that was the first thing my mother saw, was the photo of the six men, six of the seven men, the black and white photo with the Japanese flag, and she said, "Oh my gosh, that's my Uncle John." And so we read the article, and that was the first we heard of it. So that was back in 1994, I was pregnant with my youngest daughter at the time, and it's taken me this long to get going on the story and have Uncle John's service documented and published. My youngest daughter is now 22.
What was that moment like for you, at the time you're pregnant with this next generation, you're looking at your mother, and this photo of World War II, that had to have been quite a sort of mind-expanding moment.
It was very intriguing. I didn't have any idea what a code talker was. I'm a teacher, so I actually brought the newspaper article into my classroom the next day, and I wanted to share it with my students because it was just such an interesting article. The article, I don't know if you know, was an interview with the last, at the time, surviving Lakota Sioux code talkers, that's what he called it. Philip LeBlanc was his name. And so the reporter had actually interviewed him about the service. So Philip and my Uncle John and the other ones were this little group in the 302nd Reconnaissance Troop. So it was actually his memories recorded. So it was just so interesting to me that I wanted to share it with my students. I thought that that would be a nice little bit of history to share. Unknown to me, my colleague that I worked with knew all about the code talkers and could explain it all to me. and that just piqued my interest even more.
Did you know your uncle growing up? Had you met him?
No, he actually died in, I think, 1949.
Okay.
It's my mom's sister's brother. So they spent a lot of time together when she was growing up.
So, and he never talked about it to her? She didn't know
No, nobody knew.
Nobody knew.
That was the first we heard of that specialized service, yeah.
All right, so the Navajo code talkers are fairly well documented, and it took you 20 years to do your research, partially because you're a teacher and have some other things going on, but also because this research is not necessarily easy to come by. Tell me what the research process was for you.
Oh, my gosh. So I just started, with what I had. So I contacted the reporter of that newspaper article, and I contacted the code talker because he was still alive, and I called and asked the questions. But, if you do any kind of research, if you don't ask the right questions, you don't get very much information. And because I was so new at everything, I was only asking basic information. Looking back, I realize that now. But I just went from there. Who else could I call? Who could I find? I didn't really get very far between those two. I ended up going to our local veterans association here, and he actually sent me off in another direction to contact the First Cavalry Association, because the 302nd was the specialized unit in the First Cavalry. So I contacted them, and they allowed me to place an ad in their alumni association newsletter. And sometime after that, I received an actual letter in the mail from a man named Jack Langan, who at the time lived in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And he actually witnessed the code talking in action. He was a bugler. He was stationed right by the headquarters tent as his job. People didn't know that he actually was a very fluent Lakota speaker. So he understood all the messages. He knew what was going on. And he was the first, like, that was so exciting to just get that letter. I probably jumped up and down.
did he learn Lakota there during the war, or did he come into the unit knowing something?
He was actually half Lakota. I believe it was his mom. And he grew up on one of the reservations. I don't remember exactly which one. It's been so long. He grew up speaking Lakota. But he was also half white, so he just looked, you know, not the part. But he understood everything.
Yeah.
And he didn't tell anybody because it was top secret, so... He kept a secret.
This is a nonfiction book. It's for young readers or young adult readers. It reads very well for adults as well, of course. But let's talk about the importance of including all the information that you did about traditional life and values in the book. And mm-hmm. considering the sort of primary audience, why was that significant to you? Why was that important to put things in about... respecting your elders and other traditional values into the work?
You're asking a really good question. I guess it started with, you write what you know. So what did I know about the culture was basically what my mom and my dad, actually was German, but he had similar values, what they taught us when we were younger. And I just felt like there had to be that starting place of a normalcy of that kind of tradition on the plains before one of the questions that kept me going all the way through was, why in the world would my uncle and the others join the cavalry for obvious reasons? And so, that question just stuck in my mind. So I had to kind of go backwards before I could move forward.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes. And let's state one of the obvious reasons, which is wounded knee, and it's talked about in the book. Let's talk about why these men made the decision to serve their country of the United States when they had plenty of reasons not to.
Yeah, after being, basically hunted and attacked, that really... When I was doing research on all of the wars at the end of the century there, those touched my heart too, because I'm learning about my ancestors and the struggles that they went through and the massacres and how people treated each other so poorly. And then, even moving forward, my mother had a fine boarding school experience, but I know other people didn't. But one of the main things, don't speak your language. They got in trouble. Mm-hmm. And now, a short time later, they're choosing to go into the first, the cavalry, and they're choosing to use this language that they got punished for. Those questions just kept, driving me, trying to figure it out. And I think that's probably going back to your original question. Why was it important? I had to learn about the culture and the tradition. What were those values that really... take over their life? Like, that's how they live their life, the warrior mentality, the values and the virtues of the Lakota people, that's their life. Mm-hmm. And that's how they make their decisions, to protect Mother Earth, to, step up and, be honorable, act in an honorable way for their family. I mean, that's quiet warriors.
Right. Let's talk about the details of really how they worked. What were their actual jobs? What did you learn?
So that was a really challenging part because, trying to find the documents of those kind of specific things. There was a fire in St. Louis that took away a lot of the documents. Mm-hmm. I scraped through all of the National Archive documents that I could get, you know, finding message files and things like that, trying to piece things together. I only had a few people that I found that talked about, you know, what their particular specific jobs were. So at one point there were people at headquarters, obviously taking in the messages and translating them for the generals and then sending the messages back out. And from what I understood, there were two people in the field at a time, mostly doing the reconnaissance, moving behind the enemy line, taking, you know, down enemy count, determining what the condition was of the soldiers that they were observing, trying to do it secretly, obviously. At times they would encounter the enemy and they would have to defend themselves or, you know, capture them for more information. And then some of the other ones were just on regular duty, you know, guard duty or whatever, and they kind of rotated around.
You have messages in the book. Tell me the process of sort of deciding what to share and getting as close as you can to, you know, an authentic message that would have gone back and forth and the significance of those messages.
Yeah, great question. So, you know, I had a whole bunch of incoming and outgoing message files, and those were all typed messages in English. Obviously, the, you know, Indian languages aren't, they're based more in an oral tradition, so a lot of them aren't written down, or back then, mostly not written down. So I went through, you know, as a writer, trying to tell the story, which messages follow the story arc of where I was, you know, where their unit was in time, in that particular time. I had to follow the dates. But I also wanted to find the ones that move the story forward. Once I found those message files, I have an elder friend who my mother suggested to contact and see if she would translate those particular messages. And so she worked tirelessly, very diligently, translating all of those messages and writing them out for me. She also made a cassette for me of her speaking the messages. But for me, not being a language speaker, I don't really understand that process. And then once I had those messages and I typed them up, I sent them back to her again to make sure I spelled everything correctly. And then once I was done with that part and I had a contract for the book, I found another Dakota elder who could read the messages, and he verified that, yes, those were, you know, accurate in the Lakota language.
So from a linguistic standpoint, not every word that they maybe needed to say sort of existed in the language. What kind of training occurred from just being a Lakota speaker to being a Lakota code talker?
So one of my friends that I picked up along the way, his name is Dr. William C. Meadows. He's the author of the Comanche Code Talker book.
Okay.
He's an anthropology professor. And he's done a tremendous amount of work about categorizing all the different tribes that have code talkers. So for the Sioux Code Talkers, my uncle's unit, they use just conversation. So what Philip LeBlanc said when they got on the phone, it was just like talking to your relative. They recognized who the voice was, and they just took the message the way it was. So it was like conversation. There are many other tribes, though, that actually, like the Navajo, created another code within the code and had to go through the training, you know, what word stood with for what. And so even if you spoke that language, if you weren't trained as a code talker,
right,
you didn't understand it.
Yeah. So,
but in my uncle's unit, the seven that were in the 302nd, they just conversed on the phone. So there wasn't, like, real training that way.
We mentioned earlier the renown of the Navajo code talkers. What does it mean to kind of get the story out of Lakota code talkers or Sioux code talkers for sort of the tribe itself going forward, for kids who are growing up on the reservation now? What are your hopes for the book in reaching them and what it might do for them?
Oh my gosh, I think all children need inspiring role models, and this story, really investigating it for these 20 years, and I know I didn't work on it, you know, every day, but really changed my life and, you know, how I accepted myself and my identity, because, you know, growing up off the reservation in a different area here, I wasn't, it's not as bad as some areas, but I, you know, I struggled with it because I was the only one here in my classes, you know, my brothers and sisters were the only ones that were Sioux Indian. You know, we all need role models, and these men, you know, just took it under, you know, their responsibility to fight for our country, to fight for Mother Earth. You know, that was the main thing, and to put aside all of these other, you know, prejudices and difficulties that they had, to just move forward and work together. I mean, that's the bottom line. And if, you know, our children, no matter where they are, can see that message, then I think I did my job. And I hope that, you know, Jack's not around anymore. He was the one that really pushed me to write a book when I didn't really know how to write. And he just really wanted this story to come to fruition. And I wish he was here today to see it, but I hope, you know, he's proud.
You say early in the book that this story sort of begins and ends with Sitting Bull. Can you explain that, the connection near the beginning of the story and the close of the story to Sitting Bull?
So our band of people are Hunkpapa, and so our leader was Sitting Bull. So that, you know, I didn't plan it out when I started it, but, you know, to start with the history of the 1800s and, you know, the leaders that they had, Sitting Bull was one of the bigger ones that I researched, gathering a lot of information. Obviously, he's, you know, our chief from the past. When I ended, I knew my cousin was a fine artist and photographer, so I actually asked him if he would design the cover of the book. He's also on the tribal council and working, you know, as a leader in our tribe right now. And he is actually a descendant and ancestor of Sitting Bull. So it just kind of gives me the goosebumps when I think about it, because it wasn't a plan at all. It took me a while to realize that was what happened.
Right. Do you feel like you set the record straight? Someone says early on that you need to set the record straight. Do you feel like you did that?
I hope that the facts, you know, the way they were organized did that. I'm proud of all of the co-talking groups. And Jack, again, was the one that really pushed to make sure that this group is recognized, that people are aware that these Sioux co-talkers existed and participated and served our country well. And I'm, you know, going through all of the lobbying efforts through Washington and having everybody come together. I'm proud of all of the co-talking groups. So
you've been listening to Andrea Page. The book is called Sioux Code Talkers of World War II. Page presents at the Siouxland Library's downtown branch in Sioux Falls tomorrow, August 1st at 6:30 p.m. Central Time. And that program is for all ages.